Welcome to JP Morgan Asset Management's Insights Now podcast. My name is Meera Pandit, and I'm a global market strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Grant Papa, who is a research analyst on our Market Insights team. Given the many headlines and stories in the news today, we thought it would be a good time to address some of the top client questions we're getting from clients in a mailbag episode. Whether these questions come from the many clients I get the opportunity to speak with on the road or through our inboxes like our MIQs, there is no shortage of interest in hearing insights on some of today's most pressing issues. So let's jump right into it. Grant, you know if I had my way, I would have a prop for this episode, either like a fishbowl with some questions we could pull out or a courier bag where we could open up some letters, but that didn't fly. So instead, we'll have to rely on some of the different questions that we're both hearing from clients. Now, you're at the front lines of our MI Market Insights questions mailbox where clients and advisors will email in about some of the things that are on their minds or their clients' minds. Where are people's heads at right now? What is on the minds of investors?
Right. Well, thank you for having me on. You know, there's many places, as you mentioned, we could start this conversation. But I think the top question we're getting, you know, most frequent is about the conflict in the Middle East. Now, I won't ask you to, predict the trajectory of the conflict itself. But how has our outlook for the rest of this year changed, if at all, across inflation, growth, and so on?
So far, it hasn't changed that much yet, and big emphasis on yet. We're still in the throes of this. We have to see how it plays out. Just for everybody's benefit here, we're filming this in mid-April, so in 2 weeks when this comes out, a lot may have changed. But over the course of this conflict so far, we have been relatively anchored to our view at the beginning of the year. And the view at the beginning of the year was trend-like growth because we'd have elevated tax refunds and that would help boost growth in the first half of the year, somewhat slower in the second half of the year. We'd have inflation that continued to dissipate, and we'd probably have 1 to 2 Fed cuts this year. Now, in terms of how the conflict has changed some of that calculus, I think it changes some of the trajectory, but not the basic contours. So, for example, with growth, what we're seeing in the tax season so far is that those elevated refunds are coming in a little bit lower than initial estimates, but still higher than they have been in previous years. So that's helping the consumer. The challenge is you're also seeing that retail gasoline prices have risen by over $1 so far since this conflict has started. And so the most broadcast price across the economy has to be the billboard that says how much your gas price is, or at the grocery store, how much your food prices are. And that's also spilling into this. And in particular, those prices are most relevant to lower and middle income consumers because the largest share of their spending goes to some of those categories. And when you pair that with some of the tax refunds that we're seeing, that could wipe out about 60% of that benefit that the lower income population is feeling from taxes, and somewhere closer to 90% for that middle income. So how do we get to trend growth again? Well, it is possible that we do see more fiscal stimulus come down the pike, particularly because it is a midterm election year. So perhaps you see some sort of lower middle income consumer direct to consumer type of stimulus checks, perhaps, to help some of those struggling areas. Also, if the upper income consumer is still preserved, when we look at GDP, that is an aggregate number. So if someone's still doing some of the spending and driving up more of that spending, it can keep growth relatively intact. So on the growth side, not a huge change there. Inflation, even from the beginning of the year, we expected it to rise above 3% by the midpoint of the year, more related to both taxes and elevated refunds, but also some of that tariff component. Instead, now, we still think that tariff component is going to continue to put some upward pressure on goods, and Chair Powell acknowledged this as well, something he's watching. But in addition to that, we obviously have this surge in energy prices. So while we don't necessarily think that that's going to be a long-lasting effect, it could push inflation up by the summer to perhaps just below 4%. But then thereafter, you see the flip side. Energy prices start to come down, hopefully. We see a little bit more movement of oil supply. We see that you also have the fading impacts from tariffs on goods. We have less immigration, so that's a little bit less of an upward pricing pressure. And then you also fold into that, shelter costs, which have been coming down. So some of those things can help to bring inflation back into the twos in the back half of the year. So you put all that together, probably no rate cuts this year. I mean, the Fed is not very concerned about the headline inflation piece yet. inflation expectations have not taken off yet either in some of the common market measures, but they do want to watch that core goods measure. So perhaps we get one cut at the end of the year, maybe none at all until 2027. So broadly speaking, again, things haven't changed that much, but the duration of the conflict certainly matters and how long energy prices remain elevated. Right now, we're just kind of using 2022 a little bit as a signpost to say, well, that war is still going on and there's still military challenges there, but the commodity picture did normalize really within the year in that case.
And I thought it was, you know, interesting. You talked about rates. If you looked at the morning of February 27th, right, right before the conflict started, markets were pricing in about 2 rate cuts for the year. When you looked a month later, you know, mid-March, late March, that effectively been wiped out. Markets are now pricing in 0 cuts for the rest of this year. So it'll be interesting at some of the points you mentioned as well.
And you even saw like the hike for a very brief period of this, yes, where maybe we actually see the Fed hike and you see it with other central banks. Again, not our base case, but to your point, like just the expectations have varied widely.
And shifting now from, you know, the outlook for the rest of this year, but shifting to equity markets as well, which is obviously always at the forefront of investors' minds. Can you touch on this, you know, difference between market sentiment versus the actual fundamentals that's going on? You've seen a number of sectors really get wiped out, you know, a couple months ago during this, you know, software apocalypse. You know, I'd just like to hear your thoughts. I'm sure our audience would as well on, you know, this dichotomy between the two.
You and I were scratching our heads walking into this room saying, wow, markets have essentially erased their losses for the year. We're just hairs away from all-time highs yet again as of when we're recording this podcast. And I do still think that one of the defining themes of this year could be sentiment versus fundamentals. Because even though markets have clawed their way back, if we think about prior to the war, you still had markets struggling a bit, particularly around the Mag 7. The rest of the index was just modestly positive. And I think a big part of that is the winners from last year became losers this year, and those winners are just a larger part of the index. I mean, you did see that energy itself was up 25% before the war even started. And yes, there were some geopolitical things going on, Venezuela and whatnot, in the beginning of the year. But nonetheless, it was just an out-of-favor sector last year and became in favor this year. And when you look at the last couple of years we've had, it just seems like the market wants a little bit of breathing room and a little bit of digestion after 3 years of double-digit gains and after seeing valuations move a lot higher. So there is this sentiment overhang, period. Then there were also more fears around things like AI, which bled into private credit. It bled into financials, various other parts of the S&P 500, and certainly within software as a major ground zero there. But if you look at the fundamentals that we've seen so far this year, they've actually gotten stronger. So since the beginning of the year, you've seen S&P 500 earnings estimates rise from about 15% to 17, 18%. And as we go through earnings season, you often do see some upward revisions just to the quarter itself. So if you think about 3 potential years in a row of double-digit profit growth, that's a really strong foundation for the equity markets. And again, this tension between people not feeling great about things, but actually what is being delivered is pretty strong. Now, we'll feed in your previous question about the war and how that impacts the outlook. Our analysts across both the investment bank and within our asset management equity research analysts have come up with a couple of different estimates around how much earnings could take a hit. So if you had oil somewhere between $110 and $120 a barrel for 6 months' time, then it could be somewhere between a 4 to 6% earnings hit. On 17%, that still leaves you with double digits. So I do think this is going to be one of those tensions that potentially does persist through the year, unless we have a similar trajectory to 2025 where people feel a little bit more comfortable around the war and then markets go off to the races. But I will say that markets were a little bit skeptical, a little bit hesitant, a little bit tentative to start off the year. And so I think some of those concerns from the beginning of the year are just going to resurface in a bigger way that we'll be talking about more. And when I think about one of those pieces of what investors were grappling with and still are, like private credit certainly comes to mind. I mean, we think about AI displacement as a very long-term concern, and software is still, you know, hanging in the balance. But what has seen some real impacts here is private credit. And I do think that's a little bit sentiment versus fundamentals. I mean, can you break down what is going on within the private credit space? What are some of the headwinds and how you think about that in the context of sentiment versus fundamentals?
Starting with elevated redemption requests, just taking a step back, looking at semi-liquid funds, they offer typically quarterly a period where investors can request to receive distributions from the fund and apply during this window to receive some of their money back, some or all. Now, the semi portion is the ultimate. The managers or the fund managers can decide to limit the requests should it reach a certain level of the fund's net asset value, typically 5% in these semi-liquid funds, but it can be higher. And this was what the term is called gating. This is primarily done to protect the other investors in the fund so that, forced asset sales don't have to transpire, because in these funds, they're primarily illiquid loans, so they're not easily sold. So that is one issue in what's going on with redemptions, and you're seeing those requests rise. Second issue, and you touched on a lot of this with the AI fears, it's not just limited to the public markets. It's also limited to, it also extends to the private markets as well. Software companies were, darlings of private credit funds. Their recurring revenue streams are ideal candidates to lend to, because you can, adequately with reason underwrite these loans and, forecast out the cash flows. Suddenly that model is being called into question, right? Can, will these software companies even survive should AI disrupt and, ultimately maybe even dismantle many of these companies? So that's the software issue. And then third, there's the underwriting and lending standards being called into question. And we saw this late last year, some really high profile bankruptcies among, companies that were being privately lent to. Now, not all of that was private credit. There was also some leveraged loan, some leveraged loans in their capital structure as well. But really, these three issues are top of mind, and they are causing investors to question, and ultimately some decide not to be in the asset class anymore. Really what's happening though is outflows are beginning outflows. Sentiment, just like you were talking about, sentiment is starting to diverge from the fundamentals themselves. Now, defaults are picking up a little bit, we're seeing. Non-accruals are picking up a little bit, we're seeing. But this has come from very low levels. So it's very important to get that across, I think. And we're hearing that from some alts manager, from some BDC managers as well, that you're coming from a period where rising tides lifted all boats. Manager execution was not as important. You saw some loans maybe being, go to companies that maybe weren't, particularly sound. And now you're starting to see the market question these loans and these companies as well. And I think it's going to be really important going forward for investors to, one, private credit is, whether it's, in traditional drawdown vehicles or it's in the semi-liquid funds, these are long-term investments that really should not be traded in and out of. Investors should think about it in the long term, particularly with not immediate liquidity needs.
I like to say you gotta marry it. You can't date private credit.
Exactly. And second as well, I think contextualizing the size of the particular part of private credit that is under fire in the non-traded BDC and interval fund part of the asset class. Just to, put it into perspective, the overall size globally of the private credit market is estimated around, 2 to 2.2 trillion. And these are in closed-end vehicles. In the BDC space, it's roughly 500 billion. And then a smaller subset of that are the non-traded, because there's also publicly traded BDCs, but the non-traded BDCs is roughly 300 to 350 billion of that. So you're talking roughly 350 billion of the 2.5, 2.7 size of the global private credit market that is gaining a lot of attention. So I think it's important to contextualize that as well. But ultimately, I think going forward, as I mentioned, you're going to really see the difference between managers that have exhibited sound and reasonable and appropriate underwriting standards and those that have not. And really, you're going to see a divergence in the performance of these, the winners and the losers among the alts managers.
Now, when I think about the public credit markets and I think about portfolio construction and what has and hasn't worked so far this year in the context of the war and trying to hedge and diversify, is we have had a little bit of an issue during the darkest days of the war so far and the most challenged market days where you've seen stocks and bonds move together. Even on the upside, both having good days and bad days together. So those correlations have been very positive at a time when you least want that to happen. How do you think about building portfolios with that in mind?
Right. Yes. No, I actually wrote about this a couple weeks ago in our weekly market recap about how correlations, particularly after the war started at the end of February, so really the month of March, let's say, there's 22 trading days in the month of March. 18 of those 22 stocks and bonds moved in the same direction. And this is as inflation expectations were rising, particularly as the market started to price in potentially a rate cut or rate hike and lose really the rate cuts. So that, you know, that the period and the expectations of higher inflation spooked markets, and stocks and bonds are moving in the same direction. Of those 18, by the way, 12 of those were negative. But when I think about investors' portfolios, particularly maybe even, you know, during periods where inflation can be higher, really I go back to real assets. This is your infrastructure, your real estate, which can be inflation hedging assets to add into portfolios. Infrastructure, particularly through regulated utilities, they have inflation-linked pass-throughs or escalators that move in line and contracts and prices reset with rise in inflation. Same with real estate, particularly shorter-term contracts. You know, this is your multifamily or within hotels, particularly they can go overnight. Prices can increase, but they move as well and can increase prices with inflation that can ultimately help returns for investors. So really the real assets, I think, are stabilizing portfolios and, during a higher inflation or higher expected inflation periods, they can provide ballast to portfolios.
Looking for industry-leading insights on markets and the economy? Our Guide to the Markets illustrates a comprehensive array of market and economic histories, trends, and statistics through clear charts and graphs. For more information on the guide, visit our website at jpmorgan.com/GTM.
Turning away, from the U.S., I want to look at international stocks. And these had a few years of really large, particularly last year, really significant gains. Now that they've run so far, and now that we see, this conflict in the Middle East, which the energy shock disproportionately hurts, some of these developed market economies and emerging market economies. Are we still seeing opportunity in international equities, considering this conflict and how far they ran up last year?
What I will say is they ran up a lot last year. Last year was a stellar year for international equities across the board, probably the first really good year since 2017, but in the context of the last couple of years, they still have a lot of room to catch up, especially when you look at valuations. Now, if I think about the challenge that they've hit this year with some of the geopolitical issues, I think ground zero for that is an area like Europe, which will probably have a disproportionate impact from a growth and inflation standpoint. That's why you're seeing some of the hikes priced in there, but also more of a growth shock as well. But I think that in some of the other regions across the world, you may have still a little bit more insulation. So people have pointed to places like Japan and Korea and Taiwan. Luckily, we have the benefit of having a global team. So when we ask our APAC colleagues, how prepared are some of those areas for this shock? They've said, take Japan, for example. They've already started to deploy some fiscal measures and some caps to support the consumer in their country. And they do have actually quite a bit of reserves, even though they're big importers. Whereas you contrast that to some of the Southeast Asian countries, which are already starting to ration supplies. So people have different responses there relative to the supply that they have existing. What I'd also say is, let's think about the bigger picture here over the course of not just this year, but the next couple of years. And where you're seeing the most traction within international is around some of these big themes and larger secular buildouts. So if I think about last year, the composition of returns, you got returns in international from valuation expansion, from the dollar, from earnings growth. We were very much anchoring our enthusiasm for international in that earnings growth story. Because even if in the long run, valuations can still catch up to the U.S. or catch up to the long-term discount, and even if the dollar can fall, that may not be a straight line. And that's what we've seen this year, where actually the dollar and valuations have worked against international, but the earnings growth has been actually spectacular in certain regions. You know, within emerging markets, it's just about 20% earnings growth expectations for this year. And you have areas like Korea, Taiwan, contributing to that AI build out as critical nodes within that AI supply chain. Japan's earnings look pretty strong as well. You think about some of the fiscal support that they've seen over the years. Maybe not so good for their currency or for their bonds, but certainly has been good for their equity markets. So we do think about some of these multi-year themes. And I'd add on to that, that these themes have evolved over time. You know, for a couple of years there, European luxury goods and India consumer were doing really well, Chinese consumer. But now you're seeing different themes like defense crop up, corporate reform in different areas as well. So keeping track of some of those longer term catalysts, I think, is the way to invest most effectively in international.
Right. Yeah. And you know, should this conflict, you know, short term, but obviously, you know, we're thinking more longer term as well, you know, stories and structural themes that, you know, you laid out, the, you know, corporate governance reform in Japan, chips in Taiwan, memory and hardware in Korea, aerospace and defense in Europe. These are more longer term structural stories that, you know, yes, there might be some, you know, dislocation in the shorter term, but over the long term, they're still expected to play out, you know, quite well. I guess I'll wrap up with one more question on a really coming into the year, typical year, you would expect this to get a lot more, you know, headlines, a lot more attention. That's the upcoming midterm elections in November. Now, there's been quite a lot of stories in markets so far the last, you know, 3 or 4 months, so they haven't got as much attention. But, you know, now that the calendar's starting to turn, we're in the second quarter now. How should investors think about investing in an election year, a midterm election year in this case? And I want to know as well, is should the composition of, you know, the House of Representatives, the Senate, change from what's currently at? How does that impact some of our outlook, maybe that we had coming in this year about potentially a, you know, the deregulatory environment, for example?
So it's still a ways away from the midterms, and a lot can happen between now and then. But there's two principal outcomes. Either things stay the same and you have one party that governs the White House and all of Congress, or you have divided government split between either one or both chambers of Congress and the White House. And if that's the case, then ultimately the administration's ability to continue to execute on its goals will be more challenged. So that's why if we are going to see fiscal, better be before the midterms, because after that, it's going to be a lot harder to pass things. So we tend to see this gridlock during divided government. And if I think about some of the areas the administration has been more proactive about, like tariffs versus slightly less proactive about, I'd say regulation is one of them, then some of that regulatory agenda may not actually completely get done, and the climate might change. What we have seen from a regulatory perspective is there hasn't been so much active deregulation, so much as sort of a passive, or I know you described permissive deregulation, where the climate for deal making and the like has just felt more favorable, and therefore you've seen a lot get done. So you could see a switch in areas like that. Now, in terms of how we think about investing in election year, I have sort of three kind of pithy rules. The first is past performance does not dictate future results. And while people will say, oh, well, everybody knows that returns are high, are lower and volatility is higher in a midterm year, while that's actually true if you go all the way back to like the 1930s, think about the climates in some of those years. That skews the data massively. I mean, even just in the recent memory, the last time we had a midterm, it was 2022. And that was a year that was really challenging, not only because of geopolitics, but because the Fed was raising rates the fastest it's done since the 1970s. So that was more of a challenge for markets than midterms. And then you think about the midterms before that in 2018, you had trade war going on. You again had the Fed raising rates faster or more so, I suppose, than people were comfortable with from a market perspective. So it was really right at the end of the year in 2018, despite explosive earnings growth that year, that you saw markets really fall apart, very much Fed related, after the midterms. So it's hard to say that midterms cause this or midterms are bad years. It just so happens that we've had some challenging things happen in midterm years. The second thing I'll say is markets don't like uncertainty, and elections almost always reduce it. So you tend to see that volatility does tend to be higher in the year leading up to a midterm and then starts to quiet down a little bit after it, as there's one less potential question mark out there. And it really doesn't matter what the outcome is. Markets are just glad to move on from it. And then the last thing I'd say is don't let how you feel about politics overrule how you think about investing. We can see this in survey data that people feel about the economy based on who's in the White House and whether they voted for them or not. And you can see that in consumer sentiment as well, just very low in the last string of years across multiple administrations, because the people filling out the survey are the ones that are not happy about election results. But if you look at returns, this is kind of uncanny to me, but if you look at the average annualized return in the Obama administrations together and Trump won, they were basically identical, about 16% on the S&P 500. If you look at Trump 2 and Biden, also almost identical returns, around 13%. So if you didn't invest or you stayed on the sidelines because you didn't like the guy in the White House, regardless of who that was, you may have really missed out on some spectacular returns that we've had over the last several, many administrations across both parties. So those are a couple of just shorthand ways I like to think about investing in a politically laden environment where temperatures are hot.
And I like that the slide that we have in the bench deck that really just lays this out and shows that, you know, the party that's in power, they often feel better about the economy, but as you say, the returns across, you know, across administrations really have been strong. And then just going back as well to the, you know, some of the comments you said at the beginning of your answer here, the more permissive regulatory environment, that was one of the key really beliefs that we had coming in this year about why we were really excited in the private markets about, you know, private equity deal activity, the exit environment. You know, remains to be seen what happens should one party rule cease to exist for the remaining years of the Trump administration. You know, this is really provide some real tailwinds for large tie-ups and mergers, which have seen, you know, M&A, deal value last year was the highest it's ever been. You know, should that change? We'll see. Ultimately, financing costs usually are the number one reason why some of these deals happen. But that's something we're going to keep a close eye on, you know, should that change with the new government coming in.
Well, Grant, if we did have the fishbowl that I wanted, I think that would be all of the questions that we have for today. Thank you so much for joining and indulging me here. There is truly no shortage of topics and questions for us to talk about right now. And a big thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into another episode of JP Morgan Asset Management's Insights Now podcast. We hope you will join us again next time.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.